Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today, for the full hour, we're going to be talking with Boston City Councilor and mayoral candidate Tito Jackson. Yesterday, we spoke with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. And the election is less than 3 weeks away now, so we also want to hear from you. Call with your questions for Councilor Jackson. We'll be talking about housing, race, and education. Call 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. You can also, if you want, watch this broadcast live on our Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/Radio Boston. And Councillor Tito Jackson is with us in the studio. Councillor, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Meghna. It's wonderful to be here.
Great to have you.
And it's just cool to be on Radio Boston.
I appreciate the compliment, but it's not going to get you far. You're going to get the full
Radio
Boston treatment.
I absolutely know.
So let's start here. I'd like to actually start exactly where I started yesterday with the mayor, and that's with the Amazon bid, because economic development ties a lot of the big issues that Boston faces together. Mm-hmm. Mayor Walsh told us yesterday that he's putting forth East Boston and Suffolk Downs as his primary proposal for Amazon. What do you make of that?
I think Amazon is a very profitable company. I believe that they should want to come to the city of Boston. It's the best economic environment. Understand, I did bids such as this under Governor Patrick when I worked for him. I did economic development, in particular in tech. I helped to bring Google and Microsoft here and increase their presence here. But what we didn't do is we didn't give $25 million golden handshakes under Governor Patrick. It is critical that economic development occurs, but we need to sell Boston from a qualitative perspective and not from how much we're going to hand to multi-billion dollar companies. And so, again, Amazon would be, it'd be lovely to have them here. We do need to think about the imprint that they're going to make. Understand, 8 million square feet, which is what they want to build. I'm not that good with what square feet look like. That's about 10 John Hancock buildings that we're talking about. And we need to think about what it's going to mean for gentrification, displacement, and in the housing market, which we need to look at what's happening in Seattle. And there's a huge upward pressures there. And so we need to put that into context.
So let me just jump in here, because you said you mentioned the word golden handshake. You're referring to GE?
Yes, I am referring to GE.
Because yesterday the mayor said to us that in his first proposal here for Amazon, there are no incentives in there. He didn't necessarily say that there wouldn't be going forward, but at least in this first sort of possibly most important go-around, he's not offering any tax incentives.
Well, so, so first off, the proof is in the pudding. The mayor has stated that he signed documents in the past that he didn't read, such as the Olympic joinder. So I think it's really critical that we think about what's happening. What we saw with the Olympics was a $9 billion quote-unquote bid, and then I was the only one on the city council who stepped forward and made them show us the bid. Charlie Baker showed us that it was $12 billion, not $9 billion. So the proof is in the pudding, and I look forward to seeing the actual transparent bid. We need to make sure that the people of the city of Boston know what the mayor is promising, and I look forward to having that bid put out.
So you haven't seen it yet?
I haven't seen it. There was a meeting today, which I was unable to attend, but I look forward to it
being
published.
A meeting with other city councilors?
I believe elected officials, yes.
Okay, and you weren't able to be there.
No.
The mayor has said that he's going to release the bid tomorrow, so everyone will see here. But, I mean, the reason why we started with Amazon yesterday with Mayor Walsh had a lot to do with housing, because let's say for a second that Amazon did come. Yeah. It says 50,000 extra jobs would come along with it. Yeah. And you mentioned Seattle. In the past couple of years in Seattle, apartment rents, for example, we did a segment about this, have gone up more than 60%.
Exactly.
And Boston already has a major housing issue. But can you see the potential for actually a positive benefit to the housing problem if Amazon were to come? Because maybe you could get them to be a great corporate citizen and help with the housing issue.
Well, my issue is simply this. This is where a mayor actually needs to lead and not follow. And what we've seen with this mayor is an unwillingness and a timidness to actually step forward and follow and actually lead in this space. I have put forward an agenda that would require 25% affordable housing if you're building over 10 units. Yeah, you know what? If we had that type of push, if we had another push on land that the city owns that would require a third, a third, a third, a third market, a third middle income and workforce housing and a third low income, then we could see some transformative things. But what we've seen from Mayor Walsh is inability to negotiate thoroughly with companies and, in fact, giving away the whole farm. I think there's an opportunity here, but we need to be very thoughtful about what this could mean for the marketplace here. 50% of people in Boston make $35,000 or less.
Individuals.
Yeah. And I know, you know, folks would say the median income is $50,000. What we are also talking about is a Boston Public Schools that does not teach kindergarten through 12th grade computer science. Remember, Amazon is used to be called Amazon.com, right? It is a tech company. So if we are not training our young people to be part of the technology sector, then we are doing most of this for naught when it comes to actually having the pipeline and actually uplifting people who are here in Boston versus those who are not here. Because we have a shortage of people who have these tech skills.
So let me just jump back to housing specifically, because you mentioned just briefly what has been one of the centerpieces of your housing proposals. And, and just let's go over it in a little bit of detail, because you said if there's a Jackson administration, that you would call for 25% affordable housing requirements for developments of 10 units or over.
Yes.
And if you build on land that's owned by city, on public land, you'd have that one-third low income, one-third market rate, one-third middle income development. Okay, so pretty straightforward there, and it looks very attractive, but I got to let you know that yesterday we asked Mayor Walsh for his response to your plan.
Yes.
And for folks who weren't able to hear it, I want to play it for him. The mayor, specifically about the 25% affordable housing requirement that you would call for, Councillor Jackson, in developments over 10 units, and here's what Mayor Marty Walsh said.
The 25% affordable on a 10-unit house is not going to work. People aren't going to build the house. They're not going to build the property. And I think that we're up to 18% offsite.
They're not going to build it because they can't recoup their costs.
It's not affordable. You're not going to be able to do it
for the developers.
No city or town has 25%.
So what's your response to that? He's saying it's not economically possible.
Well, actually, he misstated that. Well, so there is a city next to us that has 20%, which is called Cambridge. And Cambridge has a 20% requirement on building over 10 units. It is critical that we this actually means leadership. Right. So the mayorship in the city of Boston, by the way, is much stronger than the mayorship of Cambridge. Understand, in the city of Boston, when we vote as a city council, we only vote yes or no on a budget. Right. We are only allowed to lower a line item. We are not statutorily allowed to increase it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to take all of the credit, you have to take responsibility for doing things for the people who still live in the city of Boston. But before we even go to this component, my job will be to change the structures that have cause these disparities. And one of the ways that I will do that is I will abolish the Boston Redevelopment Authority, which is doing business as the BPDA.
Mm. But Councillor Jackson, if I could, before we get into the BRA,
okay.
I do want to get into the specifics of your proposal, because again, I asked Mayor Walsh about it, and I'm asking you about it because it does seem rather bold. And I've had a lot of people ask me, folks are tweeting me to ask Councillor Jackson, how are you going to pay for it? How are you going to make it affordable to have these, you know, one-third buckets? I mean, the mayor says it's not even possible. No one's going to build if you have to have 25% affordable.
So first off, let's go with the one-third buckets.
Okay.
There's something that's called Tent City, which is right next to Back Bay Station. And that actually has 25% low income, 50% middle income, and 25% market. So I'm not pulling this out of the sky. That is a very large development, and we've shown time and time again in the city of Boston, as well as other states, that this can be done. These mixed income opportunities are happening in D.C. and many other places. So I'm not pulling out of the sky. In addition, the voucher program that I've talked about, which would be a $5 million. Which would get us 400 subsidized vouchers. That's happening right now in Washington, D.C. And so Mayor Walsh is willing to use parts of other models, which right now he is liquidating the BHA housing. So that it's being sold. There's public-private partnerships that are occurring right now. So Cork and Jennison is going to get the housing over in Charlestown. What we need to be thinking about is what did they do in places like what used to be called Columbia Point, which is now Harbor Point. Most of the people who used to live there no longer live there. So we need to be thinking about how we actually lead in this space, that we are advocating for the people who are still here, who are being gentrified and displaced out of the city of Boston every day. And so the mayor, if he's unwilling to lead, then I think he should be willing to move aside. We need to be thoughtful. I personally have in my district negotiated an over 20% affordable deal at the Douglas apartments right next to the Piano Factory in the lower Roxbury area. It can work, and we have to have a city that's going to advocate for the people who are in the city of Boston.
You know, but the mayor would say that he has led. I mean, and yesterday he did. He brought up a lot of examples, one of them which is, for example, the Office of Housing Stability that's trying to take a look at some of those same structural issues that you were talking about in terms of cost, rent, tenancy. I mean, they're even trying to get home rule petitions passed so they can change laws here in the city.
Well, so leadership and analysis are two different things. This mayor has been willing to do paralysis by analysis over and over again.
I'm gonna push back on you there, Councilor, if I could, because part of the problem is that for a long time we haven't had accurate housing data in Boston to know, like, I mean, to know what the rents are, really who's being affected and precisely how.
So,
I mean, I think anyone who wants to make big changes would say you got to have accurate data in order to know how to
make changes.
Yes, we
do have accurate data, but I'm a district counselor. I face people on a day-to-day basis. About 60 families who are coming to my office every single week who are getting pushed out. And by the way, looking at the courts, there are 5,000 evictions that happened last year. Right. So as we are analyzing, people are getting pushed out. As we are cutting the data, folks are falling behind in their rents. People's rent. There are empty outs. People are purchasing buildings and pushing folks out of our city. So the city of Boston, we must move swiftly. When I was a kid, eight of us grew up in a house with a driveway and a backyard. That was normal on my street. Families are fighting, and families at every economic level are having a tough time. So we need to have urgency. This mayor has been in office for 3.5 years, and in that time, most of the housing that is being built, 87% of it, is slated to be built for people over 20%. If he said they're already doing 18%. I am someone who I believe visionary and courageous leadership means we need to push and uplift and ensure that we're going higher than we have done before. And that's what the people of Boston deserve. And that actually is what the city of Boston deserves.
But tell me more about your numbers, though, because we got numbers from the housing, the city's housing department, and they say that of the housing that's already been constructed or permitted under the Walsh administration, that 8,900 of those units are accessible to low and middle income folks, both deed restricted and naturally occurring price points at low and middle income.
Okay, so I've been doing it by year. So let's also note 2014, 2017, the data that I have is about 20% has actually been affordable. Again, why aren't we going up? Right. So if because of the huge economic uptick and the cost of housing currently, why aren't we riding that wave, a market based wave, to build more affordable? And understand, Magna, the issue that we also have is the definition of affordable. Mm-hmm. And I like to say tongue in cheek, affordable is kind of like the word love. It means different things to different people. Currently in Boston, we use the area median income. So that's right. Not only Boston, that's Wellesley, Newton, Brookline, all of these other places. So that means the current definition of affordable in Boston is about $70,000 to $120,000 in Boston. Go to Copley or go to Melnia Cass and Mass Ave. Look at what homelessness looks like in a city. And I'm chair of education. 3.5 years ago when I took over, there were 1,500 students in the Boston Public Schools who were homeless that we knew of. Today, that number is over 4,000 homeless students in the Boston public schools. We are moving backwards and not forward on these issues. And if we don't take aggressive leadership, and if we, and again, you can't take all of the kudos and not take the responsibility for leading in this space.
So I'm glad you brought up this question of median income and how that maps on affordability, because that's something you've also talked about a lot. And I actually asked Mayor Walsh about this yesterday as well, because we were looking at area median income figures provided by HUD for Boston. And I asked him about it. I said, for a four-person household, HUD says it's $100,000 is the area median income. And I reminded him that you have been saying that you want median income to be done or analyzed by neighborhood, right? Yes. Saying that should be the guideline, not the sort of aggregate Boston numbers. And we reflected some of those neighborhood numbers. And again, Charlestown area median income, and this is from slightly older data from 2009, but $83,000 if you're in Charlestown for a household of four, $42,000 in Mattapan, $30,000 in Roxbury. Those are the numbers I reflected back to him. Now, my question for you, though, is you're right. Like, obviously, this is a city of high income inequality, so median income is going to vary incredibly from neighborhood to neighborhood. Yeah. But what I want to know is when you're talking about constructing affordable housing, right? When you're talking about constructing low and middle income housing, there are a lot of players involved, a lot of organizations, a lot of institutions, HUD being one of them, lots of financial institutions, for example. If you start saying we're going to use this set of numbers for neighborhood median income, but everyone else is using like HUD numbers, how is that going to work? How are you going to get people to talk to each other about that?
Well, I think we have to have conversations that are realistic, right? So understand, in Grove Hall, which is the neighborhood I live in, the average income for that family is $25,000, right? So when you're building a unit and you call it affordable and you brand it an affordable unit and it's for someone who makes $70,000, that is three times, essentially $75,000, is three times that person's or family's income. So we are not actually meeting the problem. This is actually called what government is supposed to do.
So you're going to go to Ben Carson and you're going to say, actually, what I want you to do, HUD, is say in Roxbury, we're going to redefine it to $30,000?
We need to be innovating. And if I need to go to D.C. and have a conversation with Ben Carson, who says he lived in Boston, that we should have that conversation. In addition, I also will support what Denise Provo, who's a state representative, has put forward, which is another plan that has actually been happening since 1980 in Washington, D.C. And essentially, there's a first right of refusal in a building that's going to be purchased, that's occupied by tenants. It's going to be purchased. It allows for that building to be turned into a co-op, purchased by a CDC, purchased by the city, or purchased by the individuals who actually live in that housing. That is an innovative program that would actually lend to exactly what we're talking about. And as you would note here, is it would have to be deed restricted if it were turned into a co-op. That is the type of innovation. We can't only have an innovation economy. We need to have innovation in housing in the city of Boston to make sure we are meeting these needs.
We're talking with City Councilor Tito Jackson. He is running for mayor of Boston. We're spending the hour with him. Yesterday, we spent the hour with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. If you've got a question, call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We've been talking about housing because it's possibly one of the most important issues. Well, we know it's one of the most important issues in the city of Boston.
We didn't talk about the BR. So we didn't.
We will for a second, but I'd actually just want to let some of your potential constituents have their chance to ask you their questions. So
wonderful.
Paige is calling from Dorchester. Paige, you're on the air.
Paige, thank you.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm wondering what, if anything, would be your approach for addressing skyrocketing rent prices for current units. You've talked a lot about new units. Any approach for current units?
Yes. So one of the things, Paige, that I did have was the plan that I just put forward. We are seeing a lot of developers purchase whole houses, particular three-deckers, six-deckers, and emptying them out. I believe that the people who are renting should have first right of refusal and the ability to buy them. In addition, I believe that we should put forward flexible city-funded vouchers that could actually be used to deal with the delta between what is being currently charged and how rents are actually going up. And I believe that we could do that first with an experiment of $5 million to put forward 400 vouchers to begin to deal with that. In addition, yes, we do need to build more units. The only issue, though, is if we only do a trickle-down economic approach and continue to build units at the rate we're building them and only let the market play in this, we will continue to push people out of the city of Boston. Paige, does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right. So now you did, Councilor Jackson, you did mention the Boston Planning and Development Agency. You said you were
$600,000
to change
that name.
You said you're going to abolish it? What would you put in its place?
Well, first, again, it costs $600,000 to add one extra letter to an acronym. What I would put in its place is a professional, human-centered planning agency that is run by the city. That has transparency, accountability, and democracy attached to it. Understand, right now, the Boston Redevelopment Authority, doing business as the Boston Planning and Development Authority, is not transparent. And it is only beholden to the mayor. It is only beholden to their board, which is wholly appointed by the mayor, has in many ways been the way in which people have been removed, displaced, and overrun in their neighborhoods and communities. And so it is critical now that we step forward and weaken the mayorship. And I want to be honest and transparent. This would actually weaken the mayorship because this actually means there would be transparency in planning. Because right now, we don't technically plan, I don't believe. I believe we develop, and then we back end planning based on where developers want to actually build. And then on the development side, that development should be transparent. It should be accountable to the people of the city of Boston. And the dollars attached to this agency should be able to be seen by people through city government. In addition, I would increase the power of the Boston City Council. The Boston City Council should be involved and should have to take a stand on issues relative to development by vote.
You know, I take your point on this, that making things transparent, democratic, et cetera, you know, in a perfect world is great. I mean, look, I'm a member of the press. Of course I want things to be more transparent. But one could also say that the way that the office of the mayor has historically been set up in Boston, you know, has its downsides, but also has its upsides, that maybe, you know, you want the powerful mayor model because for a lot of the things that you're envisioning, a lot of the things that you're championing, that maybe you couldn't do if you made it an overly democratic process. And I say that with all seriousness.
Democracy, in that regard, we are only serving the powerful and we are not serving the people. It is my objective. And yes, the objective, I believe, to return the power to the people in the city of Boston and to democratize city government. Just because we've always done it this way, these structures are what lead to lack of transparency, lack of accountability, but it's also what leads to what we currently have is two individuals who are charged and indicted with extortion. And by the way, they are being paid $250,000 a year over the past year and a half. So much of city money is going out the door. We have to change the actual structures to add democracy and add sunshine on what's actually going on in the city of Boston.
Well,
it's not okay.
So speaking of sunshine, I do have a question for you because you have promised throughout this campaign that you would release a budget proposal.
Yes.
And so that voters could look at it.
I'm excited.
Are you excited for this?
Because it's coming next week.
Because you had promised to release it in September, and here we are on October 19th.
Governor, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm a little bit tardy on my budget proposal. Mayor Walsh, he actually was supposed to do a disparity study from day one. We're 3.5 years through. I will be releasing my FY19 budget proposal next week. And you will see the priorities that I believe in and the fact that we can fully fund the Boston Public Schools. that we can actually deal with many of these issues of housing, and that we can begin to get our arms around issues that we are facing in the Melnia Cass and Mass Ave area around opioid use, based on something that Mayor Walsh and his administration did, which is the closure and the closure of the Long Island shelter and the closure of the bridge, which has exacerbated what has occurred in the city of Boston. So you will get that next week.
Next week. Okay.
Yes.
So, but Councilor Jackson, with all due respect, I mean, sure, you're being transparent by releasing it next week, but it's just that would just be 2 weeks before the election. Is that fair to voters?
You promised it
back in September.
Well, first, unlike Mayor Walsh, I don't have 17,000 people working for me on this. We are a grassroots campaign. But I will, and in addition, I actually did a open town hall last night. We have several more coming up. And as mayor, they will have an opportunity to hear prior to my swearing in what my objectives and goals are relative to that. And again, I look forward to actually releasing that.
We look forward to getting it.
Yes.
All right, let's take a quick break here. We're talking with City Councilor Tito Jackson about his views and his hopes and his plans should he be elected mayor of the city of Boston. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Call with your questions or send us a tweet at Radio Boston. We'll be back in about 60 seconds. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're spending the hour with Boston City Councilor and mayoral candidate Tito Jackson. Yesterday, we talked with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, and we just had a good conversation about housing and the city's budget. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Call with your questions for Councilor Jackson, or go to Twitter and send us a tweet at Radio Boston as well. And Councilor Jackson, we do have a lot to talk about regarding race and policing and education, but I do want to give folks a chance to ask a question of you.
Awesome.
So Joe is calling from Hyde Park. You're on the air, Joe.
Hi, how are you? Quick question on property tax.
Yeah.
The middle class is going to be footing the bill for property tax in the city for a long time. We got a lot of institutions, colleges that are going for, they're not paying anything. Why don't we charge these people just something like 1%? We can raise some revenue for the city, and also busing, the cost versus its value still.
Joe, thanks for your question.
Thank you very much, Joe. This issue of colleges and universities, which is called payment in lieu of taxes.
Right, those
right?
pilot payments.
Pilot payments. And what we've seen, sadly, is that we've seen those come down. Right. So there was a study done and a couple of years ago, they were much higher than they are right now. I believe that we should look at pilot payments on an annual basis. We should have to have an annual reporting of the pilot payments. And we also need to know, and Joe brings up a really good fact, half of these pilot payments are able to be done in kind. Which means that it may not have a dollar of value attached to it. So I think that's a critical component. One of the other components that we should look at with pilot payments is that we should look at procurement. And under my administration, we will have an anchor institution procurement and employment office where we are looking at the spend of actual colleges and universities. Are they working with Boston-based businesses? Are they and a school like Boston University spends $2.1 billion on an annual basis in their operating budget? How much of that goes to Boston businesses? How much is that of that goes to businesses owned by people of color? And how much of that goes to women-owned businesses and veteran-owned businesses? That is a way to make Boston an even stickier place to do business. And we have a bunch of colleges and universities and hospitals. So if we look at their spend, and if we say, and I would say 10%, I was able to negotiate with Northeastern University a 15% requirement in their institutional master plan. Why does this matter? Because schools like University of Pennsylvania actually track their spend in Philly. They spend about $268 million, and then they look department by department on their actual spend.
Do they have
and
to
the
do
hiring.
That because it's the University of Pennsylvania? I mean, how would you do that with...
Well, actually, what I would do here is each school has to do an institutional master plan every 10 years. They have to say what they want to build, and they have to cut a deal with the city to be able to build it. This should be part of their institutional master plan.
You would introduce it as
I
that.
Would definitely
okay.
introduce, and I use this model with Northeastern University. In addition, we required them to use 30% of their minority business enterprise to build buildings and 10% for women. We need, and also we got a $1.5 million revolving loan fund for working capital. So these are the types of deals that are over and above Pilot. He also brings up something really important around property tax. We should definitely be thinking about ways so that people are not saddled, and in particular elders. I met an elder in South Boston who had $11,000 a year property tax bill, but he made $22,000 a year. Mm-hmm. We want to make sure that elders are able to age in place and that that tax burden doesn't push people out of their homes.
All right. So let's talk about race in Boston, because, of course, this is a majority minority city. It's a city of people of color. And when we hosted you, Councillor Jackson, at our mayoral forum at UMass a couple of months ago, you were very passionate about your criticism of the Walsh administration on a number of points regarding race. I mean, you criticized the administration for what you called the underfunding of the city's chief resilience officer. You basically said it's funded for one position. We should note, though, that that is because it's been funded by a two-year grant from the Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors, and the grant is written that it's for the money is for that one position.
But other cities have matched that funding. And so, again, how does the mayor take credit for something that they got a grant for, right? That's not on the city budget. And a budget is a value statement. And so if no city money is going into it, how is it that Mayor Walsh can take credit? And again, Atiyah Martin is one of the most talented individuals that I've ever met in that space. But she's one person. And she's done yo woman's work in that role. We need to give her a functional budget. And by the way, her impetus is and push is around race.
Mm-hmm.
And so with a city with such a storied history, she needs a robust staff and funding to be able to do that work.
So I asked Mayor Walsh about this yesterday, and he had quite a pointed response to your criticism of him and the funding for the resilience officer or office in the city. And here's what he said.
He's had an opportunity as city councilor for the last 4 years to, honestly, if he felt it wasn't adequately funded, why didn't he bring it up in the budget in 2014, which he voted for, or the budget in 2015, which he voted for, or 2016 or 2017? He didn't vote for those two. I mean, there's plenty of opportunity during his career to bring up these issues. And for the last 4 years, we've talked about these issues. My opponent also hit me saying that I vetoed a program for black and brown boys that he passed to the council. The reason why we didn't move forward with that, because we had My Brother's Keeper that President Obama asked Boston to be part of, and which we did. And then when the council got the commission for on black and brown boys, he held one hearing.
So
let's talk about the hearing. If you're going to have a commission, how come you only hold one hearing?
It's really interesting because there's not a commission. And so Mayor Walsh is misstating what actually occurred. So let's understand what happened. I put forward legislation to create a black and Latino men's commission. This is actually prior to My Brother's Keeper being announced. In Philadelphia, there's a commission. And several other cities, there are these commissions. We engaged over 700 people to have this conversation. Mm. And it passed the Boston City Council 13-0. 13-0. And Mayor Walsh vetoed it. So if you really care about, and we also knew that President Obama wasn't going to be in office forever. What this was modeled after is the Women's Commission, which has been successful in the city of Boston in closing many of the gaps around pay as well as equitable treatment of women. And it's a standing commission. And so that is one of the reasons why I put that forward. In addition, Mayor Walsh has been unwilling to deal with systemic racism in City Hall. And one point around this is Chantel Charles, who was awarded by a jury $10.9 million. She's worked for City Hall for over 20 years. She's had the same title since 1986. The jury gave her a judgment for discrimination and retaliation, and the mayor appealed it. And it was upheld on appeal for $4.5 million, and they're appealing it again. In addition,
It sounds like in that case, in particular, Councillor Jackson, I mean, you're heaping that all on Mayor Walsh. She's had the same title since 1986. There was another mayor in charge during most of that time.
There was, and it is our job, and this is the issue. Systemic. There's a system here, right? It's not about an individual. We're not talking about racist. we are talking about racism, which is a system. And so it is critical that we do right. And what Mayor Walsh didn't do is that there was no nothing was done, no repercussions for the person who was the manager there. Right. So that is what you need to actually change. In addition, disparity study. The disparity study, and which Mayor Walsh promised as a candidate, a disparity study allows us to have goals for purchasing for women, people of color, veterans, and the like. And interestingly, Charlie Baker, the governor, the Republican governor, has done two while he has been in office. Mayor Walsh has done zero, a goose egg. The reason why this is significant is a disparity study takes at least 2 years to do. Mayor Walsh, the day before the debate, which he finally was willing to figure out how to speak to the people, and I would say I believe it's...
Well, in a debate format.
But,
I mean,
in a debate format. But this is voter suppression, and I want to be...
Suppression?
It is suppression.
How is it voter suppression for the mayor to not debate?
The engagement... And I have to say this. The engagement that is needed for people in the city of Boston, I believe, has suppressed. And it's the reason why we only saw 50,000 people come out in a major American city on September 26th. That's real. And I believe having more debates is the way that engagement actually happens
in the
city of Boston.
Okay, but Councilor Jackson, please. It's because I have to ask you more about this because you used the word suppression. That is very different than engagement.
Well,
suppression makes it sound like you're insinuating that the Walsh campaign is out there keeping people away from the polls.
But they are.
They're not doing anything of the sort.
They're keeping people away from the conversation, which leads to keeping people away from the polls. Let's look at that voter turnout in 1983. Right. Let's go back to Mel King and Ray Flynn. Each of them, they both actually got the same amount that I got, 29%. Each of them got 48,000 votes. And so what I would say to you, again, if we're talking about transformative leadership, that means you sit down, you have the conversation, and you engage people. If not, people check out and they're not able to actually engage in the conversation.
I think but Councilor Jackson, with all due respect, shouldn't you also be putting some of the impetus on the voters of the city of Boston? Like, in order for a democracy to work, they have to want to be engaged.
Well, they have to want to be engaged. And I would also say to my friends in the media, right?
You're sitting here with me today.
I am sitting here with me yesterday.
But
you're not making us sit together. And I want to be very, very real here, right? We've now had two separate conversations, and you were stellar in your ability to interview people. But it does mean something when we are having separate conversations and we are not having a debate. There's a couple of chairs
here. Well, there was going to be a debate on WBZ, but because of a union conflict, both you and the mayor agreed to not have that debate.
So first off,
you also signed off on that.
But there was going to be a debate that WBR and my campaign manager went to a walkthrough. That was actually pulled based on the fact that Mayor Walsh did not want to do it. So what I'm saying here is that this issue of engagement, this issue of people being able to understand what is on offer, that is our job. And I would simply say to the people, if someone's not willing to stand up for their job and to fight for their job, are they going to be willing to stand up for you? Are they going to be willing to stand up for that single mom who's struggling or the grandparent who's taking care of their grandchild? Is that person willing to stand up for the city of Boston? We are a city of fighters, and we are a city that fights hard for everything that's out there, and that's what we deserve in a mayor. And as mayor of the city of Boston, I will be fighting for you, and I'm willing to sit down and have the conversation. And again, I challenge Mayor Walsh to have more than one more debate in this election cycle. It is critical for the people of the city of Boston to hear us.
But I'm gonna move on here in just a second. But I have to be clear on something. I have to ask you to be clear. Are you genuinely saying that the lack of debates is equivalent or leading to suppression? Because that has a very specific definition. Is there a legal standard for that?
What I would say is simply this, and I don't use it in jest. I believe that this lack of engagement, unwilling, and recalcitrance in not being willing to have this conversation has led to lower voter turnout, lower engagement, and less attention paid to the most important position in the state of Massachusetts, which is the mayorship of the city of Boston. It is unacceptable. It has to stop. And I look forward to folks, my friends in the press, but also in the advocacy community, holding the mayor accountable for not being willing to come to the table.
Okay. Well, so let's move on, because we got a little bit away from the issue of race in particular. But I want to ask you about, because you've been talking about how you have said that you don't feel that that very specific and important representatives of the city, police and fire in particular, represent the Bostonians themselves. So let me ask you. I mean, the mayor would disagree. He does disagree. He says that the incoming cadet class in the police academy, for example, is very diverse. But how would you actively increase or further diversity?
Okay. So first, it is interesting that we're pointing to this one class, because he's actually not pointing to the classes prior. And the record is very clear. And we've heard on the record from Mamleo and the Vulcans about the diversity or lack thereof. Under Mayor Walsh, 75% of the police officers hired in his administration have been white, and 90% of the firefighters hired have been white. This is a city that is disjointed and not connected with the demographics of the city of Boston. And I think it's really critical that we look at recruitment. Much of the recruitment is of veterans. And how is it that we are not recruiting veterans who are from a diverse background in the city of Boston, with jobs that actually are pretty pay pretty well? And again, these are, again, I want to thank the men and women who do both of these jobs on a day-to-day basis. Our police officers who go to work every single day to keep us safe, as well as our firefighters who do that work. But it is critical that we do a better job in that space. One of the ways we also make it better is that we shouldn't have discriminatory policies in the police department. One of them is a hair test that gives false positives for short, curly hair. And there have been officers of color who've been fired and had to go through lawsuits to get back on the case. This hair test has they've actually stopped using it at the TSA. And the city of Boston has spent over $1.5 million defending this hair test. And there have been several recent rulings by the court about the testing that the Boston Police Department has used that has shown that they have used testing that discriminates against specific groups of people. And on top of that, you have an individual who made a video of one of his counterparts and said something very racist in the video. And instead of taking a leadership role here, and ensuring that this individual is no longer in city service and on the police force, because
this
is conduct,
DeAngelo, you're talking
yes,
about
conduct unbecoming of an officer. Mayor Menino had something that happened somewhat in the same vein, and he actually exercised his authority to make sure that individual is no longer on the police force.
Mayor Walsh, yesterday, I asked him about this specific case yesterday, and he said that that Commissioner Evans and leaders of the church community, pastors, they worked on a solution to this problem together.
This is called leadership, and it's called having standards that in the city of Boston. Actions such as this are unacceptable. In addition, this is also a mayor who has chosen to study body cams, right? To study body cameras instead of implementing body cameras.
Well, he got a lot of resistance from the union on that. But this is a good question. I mean, I want to move to schools here in just a second. But let me ask you about body cams really quickly, and then we'll take a quick break and we'll talk about schools. But how would you break down resistance in the Boston Police Union so that body cams that all officers wear them for that transparency and accountability you were talking about?
Well, how would you do that? The issue here is that we have to have a conversation. The Boston Police Department has been sued for $38 million in the past 7 years. This is real money that has gone out the door. And so we also need to say to our police officers, this is not only an accountability for you, it's also an accountability for the public. And it's a transparency and a democracy tool. It will, I believe, keep officers safe. and safer. I also believe it will keep the community safe and safer, and it is a win-win in our city. We don't have dash cams. There was a whole show called Cops that was on for over 20 years. It's now canceled. We still don't have dash cams in the city of Boston. We should be making this leap into body cams for all of our police officers, and that should happen right away.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to call if you've got a question for Councillor Tito Jackson about why he's running for mayor of the city of Boston. When we come back, we're not going to have enough time, but when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about Boston public schools. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. We'll be right back. Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're spending the hour with Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson. He is running for the mayor of the city of Boston. Yesterday, we spent the hour with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh and Councilor Jackson. The same thing happened. We only left a couple of minutes for education, which is actually probably the most important.
I'm chair of education.
It's probably the most important issue for the city, too. So I apologize to you, to Mayor Walsh yesterday, and to all the listeners about that. But let's get a call from Mike, who's calling from Dorchester. He's got a question about schools. Mike, you're on the air.
Hey, Mike.
Thank you. Tito, for your leadership on education. I've been an educational activist for decades. School closings are very damaging to our children and our communities, and disproportionately in Boston, school closings have taken place in communities of color. The city of Boston is planning to close schools next year in the next few years. If you're mayor, will you close any schools? And if you do, what would be the criteria?
The thing that I always say when it comes to being in a hole is to stop digging. The Boston public schools, and we have a mayor who operated for 2 years as if we had thousands of extra seats. The Boston public schools actually do not have enough seats. There's 4,000 young people who are waiting to get into early education seats. I think we need to be thinking about how we build new schools. Two-thirds of our schools are built before 1945, but even before we do that, I think it's really critical that we fully fund the schools that we have. We have a mayor who has underfunded the Boston public schools by $140 million. And every school should be a nurse. We should have art and music and fully funded vocational technical education, libraries. And in my administration, we will have a kindergarten through 12th grade curriculum in computer science. So before we think about that, we should be looking at where young people live and how we can actually build opportunities, equitable opportunities for education in every single neighborhood.
Councilor Jackson, let me just jump in here. And again, we just have 2 minutes left, and I do feel terrible about that. Mm-hmm. But this question of school funding has come up over and over and over again in this race. Just yesterday, the mayor told us that he's increased the school budget in the last 4 years by $154 million. Where do you guys get your numbers from?
I get my numbers from the superintendents, and I will post them and show where he's actually cut funding to the Boston public schools, and those are from his superintendents. With that said, I would have an elected school committee. It is critical that we democratize education. Of the 351 cities and towns in the state of Massachusetts, Boston is the only one that does not have an elected school committee. In addition, we need to have free bus passes for all of our high school students. Some kids can't even afford to actually get on the bus and get to school. So that is absolutely critical. And I believe the school should be a community hub. They should actually be the center of every single community, and everything from prenatal care to adult education, vocational technical education should happen in our schools. These are thoughtful solutions. And again, we will fully fund the Boston public schools. In my budget that I'm putting out next week, I will show where we will get those dollars.
Can you give us a hint? A little preview?
We can give you a preview on paper. And I would love to come back in and give you and run through the budget. It is a critical component because understand policy without a line item is not real. $11 million was cut out of 49 public schools. You don't have to ask me. How about you ask the 3,500 young people who walked out of their Boston public schools because Mayor Walsh underfunded their schools 2 years ago, and their parents who actually protested in front front of his State of the City address. I will fully fund the Boston Public Schools. It is a value of mine, and our young people are 100% of our future. And what are we doing if we're not funding our public schools?
Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson, thank you so much for joining us this hour. It's been great. Yesterday we talked to Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. Go to radioboston.org to hear that and to hear this hour again if you'd like to. Councilor Jackson, thanks again.
Thank you so much, Meghna.
Get out there and vote in a couple of weeks, everyone. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
Number one on the ballot.